chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make heaven in the middle of it. Rest make heaven in the middle. We are. Rest make heaven.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We've got a really fine program going this evening, and we're going to start off with Alex Jones. Owen Sawyer, actually, we're going to start off with talking to Darren Beatty of Revolver. Dot news. And we're going to start off with the January 6th, and we're going to expand into that. We're even going to be playing some Liz Cheney's quotes and interviews also. So here we go with Revolver.news. Darren Beatty interviewed by Owen Sawyer. Here we go now.
Your latest piece on Revolver.news, Meet Ray Epps Part 2, Damning New Details Emerge, Exposing Massive Web of Unindicted Operators at the Heart of January 6th. What do we know about Ray Epps? Why do you suppose that, I guess he's just going to be above all this investigation? And then what are the big details in your latest piece on Revolver.news?
Well, this is our latest major piece on January 6th, and really it's required reading for anybody who maybe is not fully up to date, who's not informed about January 6th, or for anybody, you know, who has skeptical friends or family members, or if you're skeptical yourself, take what I call the Revolver Challenge. Don't take my word for it. Read that piece, but most importantly, watch the video embedded in that piece. If you go to the website version of Revolver.news, watch all of the compiled embedded videos and run through the narrative that we present. And it's impossible, I think, after doing that exercise to look anyone in the eye, to look me in the eye, tell people, read this, watch the video, then look me in the eye and tell me that the feds weren't involved. Nobody can do it. It's definitive here. And it's not just Ray Epps, by the way. Ray Epps has, I think, rightly become sort of the most prominent and infamous figure representing the Fedsurrection hypothesis. But there are a lot of other key individuals who played decisive roles in that initial breach. I mentioned the trespassing charges that are really being used politically through selective prosecution in order to punish various people, because there are hundreds and hundreds of people, if not thousands, who are technically trespassing on restricted grounds. The only problem is the overwhelming majority, probably over 95%, weren't even aware that they were committing a criminal offense because the barriers and fencing had been taken down before the crowd got there.
Or they were even waved in by police.
Or they were waved in, or both, or both. The fact is we have video of individuals methodically removing fencing way before the speech was even done, way before the main crowd even went to the Capitol at the direction of people.
Oh, my gosh. I can't even believe this. I've never actually seen this before. You have the pictures right there. They're cutting the fence down. Nobody's stopping them. What do we know about these individuals?
Well, yes, there are key individuals, and unlike Ray Epps, some of the most egregious actors here who created the preconditions for the rally to turn into the riot haven't even been identified publicly. There's one individual called Fence Cutter Bulwark who's represented quite prominently in the Revolver.news piece that you mentioned. And there's another individual, I think, who other than Ray Epps is a key figure here, but unlike Ray Epps, he hasn't even been identified. He hasn't been put on the FBI most wanted list like Epps. And, of course, they took Epps' name off there as soon as we started reporting on this stuff. But still, there's zero, total radio silence about this individual from the feds. He's known only by his moniker to researchers as Scaffold Commander. And here's a guy who was, again, he was stationed there right by at the Peace Monument, right by that initial breach site before the Proud Boys got there, before all these other people got there. He was there along with other key individuals. He ended up taking a really strategic position on top of that white scaffold that many people have seen from video footage on this. And he was directing people coolly, professionally, but constantly, move forward, move forward, move forward. And so the experience of your average rally goer, you have people like Epps directing you to the Capitol after the speech. You get there, people like fence cutter Bulwark had removed the fencing so you don't even know you're in restricted area, and then you hear this confident, definitive, and constant voice coming from a bullhorn saying, move forward, we need your help. Now, if you hear that constantly, people just as a matter of psychology, as a matter of crowd control, people obey these authoritative commands, especially when they say things like, we need your help.
Maybe, and that's just where the momentum of the mass of people was going. I mean, most people couldn't even control themselves at that point.
Exactly. Then, you know, momentum takes over, and then you're just caught up in it, and you move forward because everyone around you is moving forward. But it takes key individuals such as this scaffold commander, as of yet unidentified, but who played a decisive role in this whole operation to create the conditions for what happened. And then after he is saying move forward, move forward, move forward, he started saying, okay, we need you to climb in, we need you to go in the windows. Then he actively encouraged people to go into the Capitol and break in. But what's amazing is that the feds have really exhibited zero interest not only in arresting this guy and questioning him and identifying him. Nothing. And as of today, this key player has not been identified. Nobody knows who he is.
I mean, folks, this is just let me try to make an analogy here. Let's say that you have a big building, okay, in some metropolitan area, and there have been threats made, and so somebody comes to you and says, hey, there's been a threat made here to your building. You should get security. And then you take out a big insurance policy on your building and you don't get security. And then there's video footage of people pouring gasoline all around your building and then lighting it on fire. And then you have a big insurance payout. And then somebody doesn't investigate the person pouring gas, doesn't investigate the person lighting the fire, doesn't investigate the person that takes out the big insurance before the fire, doesn't investigate the person that stands down security before the fire. I mean, that any other investigator would say, hey, I'm going to investigate that person, I'm going to investigate those people. But not this time. The person that lit the fire, poured the gas, turned down the security and bought the insurance package is the one not being investigated in the arson. No, this is unprecedented stuff, and I think the Democrats plan to use this against innocent Americans forever. All right, we got five more minutes with Dr. Darren J. Beattie, and then Alex Jones is going to be joining us. Darren, I think they're going to be using January 6th against their political opposition forever. That's their plan. They just arrested a GOP governor candidate in Michigan just out of nowhere because he was leading in the polls. I mean, a lot of the people they're charging weren't even there in Washington, D.C., let alone my story. Never went into the building fast, never touched anybody, never did anything. But, I mean, Enrique Tarrio wasn't even there. Roger Stone wasn't even there. I think they want to take this to the next level. Oh, you talked about a rigged election. Oh, you supported Donald Trump. They want to come arrest you. I mean, where do you think it goes from here? Even though their ratings flopped, they have, I think, three more of these things planned. Where do you think this corrupted, authoritarian, tyrannical, I don't even know how else to describe this. I don't know if anything this bad has ever happened, you know, as far as a political party weaponizing the government against the people in U.S. history. Where do you think the Democrats take this next, Dr. Darren J. Beattie?
Well, that's an excellent observation, and I think it really is incumbent on us to remember what the stakes are here, what the purpose is, what is the agenda. It isn't really about January 6th. It's about the significance the false narrative of January 6 holds to further the regime's agenda. And that agenda is the reconfiguration and really the weaponization of the American national security apparatus against the American people to silence, suppress, and destroy the energies associated with movements like the Donald Trump movement, but not just that, any movement that could be threatening to the regime and its hold on power. And that's what it's about. The Department of Homeland Security is spearheading what some people have called the domestic war on terror. And guess what? Benny Thompson, who is the chairman of the January 6th committee, is also the chairman of the Homeland Security Committee. He is the Department of Homeland Security's stooge in Congress. And he's conducting an investigation, a sham investigation on January 6th, the false narrative about which is used as the propelling pretext for the Department of Homeland Security's reconfiguration as a political tool to silence and suppress and destroy Trump supporters. So that's really what's going on. Those are the stakes. That's why, despite how boring or irrelevant a lot of this stuff is, it's really just boring from the side they're talking about. It's actually explosive and dark, but extremely interesting to investigate what actually happened there, because it opens up an entire can of worms that's entirely alien to most American people who are naive, comfortably naive about the nature of their own government and the types of the operations that the government has been conducting against them, their citizens, not just on January 6th, but going back a long time. And this is just the tip of the iceberg in that regard. And so I hope everyone will go to revolver.news, read our piece with an open mind and share it, and begin the educational process, because the stakes are too high to be ignorant on this issue.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just the more they flop, it seems like the more aggressive they get. And I just want to tell you also, Dr. Beatty, that I have just been sent information from Pete Santilli. He says he has identified the fence cutting bulwark. So if you'd like, I can forward that information to you, and maybe your team can get to work on that.
Yep, we're definitely looking for tips. So we'll pursue that and see where it leads.
Wonderful. We'll send you that information. Dr. Darren Beatty from Revolver.News, thank you so much. God bless you. Godspeed. And, folks, just pray for people like Darren Beatty who are putting everything on the line to stand up against this political corruption in the Democrat Party, folks. It's no joke. These people mean business, in case you haven't noticed. They shoot and kill Ashley Babbitt, and they celebrate it. And that's just one of their political murders. So, Darren Beatty, thank you so much for joining us today. Revolver.News, folks, is where you can find all the information. All right.
So Darren Beatty doesn't have much to say or anything good about January 6th. And people are even saying that that it was possibly a setup, you know, a false flag setup. In fact, here's a question put to by Chris Wallace to Liz Cheney, talking about some people think it was a false flag. Here's what she had to say.
Woman Cheney, there is talk that January 6th was a false flag operation, that it was a case of liberals in the deep state setting up conservatives and Trump supporters. Is there any truth to that?
None at all. You know, it's the same kind of thing that you hear from people who say that 9/11 was an inside job, for example. It is, it's un-American to be spreading those kinds of lies, and they are lies. And we have an obligation that goes beyond partisanship, and an obligation that we share, Democrats and Republicans together, to make sure that we understand every single piece of the facts about what happened that day, and to make sure the people who did it are held accountable. To call it a false flag operation to spread those kinds of lies is really dangerous.
This is ongoing. You know, the JFK, you know, assassination, that was one man did it, Lee Harvey Oswald. Well, we know now that didn't happen, but they spent years after the fact of hiding, dodging, procrastinating about releasing information. And so that's the way they do it. That's the way they play the game. The JFK, the 9/11, these things are ongoing operations, in my opinion. So you can't believe statements from these politicians about these events, to tell you the truth. But coming up next is Tucker Carlson this week around the January 6th Thursday report. And here's what he had to say about three things: the Sussman trial, the Navarro arrest, and then what he said about the lunatics on the January 6th, you know what I mean, committee. So he hits it hard. Here we go with Tucker Carlson.
Good evening and welcome to Tucker Carlson Tonight. Peter Navarro is the picture of a law-abiding American citizen. He's a 72-year-old retired business school professor. He's got a PhD in economics from Harvard University. His most recent job was extremely white-collar. He served as the White House trade advisor in the last presidential administration, famous for his tough stance on China. He's never been charged with a crime. He's never trafficked fentanyl, for example, from Mexico. In fact, his hobby is yoga and riding his bicycle. In short, Peter Navarro does not seem like a criminal, much less a danger to this nation. And yet, last Friday, federal agents arrested Peter Navarro at Reagan National Airport in Washington. They did not call his lawyer, as is customary in cases like this. They didn't even come to his house, which, as it happens, is just feet from the FBI building. They could have walked, but they didn't. Instead, they took down Peter Navarro in public, as you would a fugitive terror mastermind, so everyone could see it and learn the lesson they were sending. They handcuffed Peter Navarro, they put him in leg irons, and then they threw him in a cell. He's now facing years in prison. So what did Peter Navarro do to deserve treatment like this? Well, he resisted a subpoena from the January 6th committee. The January 6th committee is Washington's latest partisan inquisition. It's run by Nancy Pelosi with help from obedient little quislings like Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger. Navarro resisted that subpoena because he had nothing to do with January 6th. Nothing whatsoever. That's not disputed. Peter Navarro did not break into the Capitol. He didn't encourage anyone else to break into the Capitol. He wasn't even there that day. He had no idea it was going to happen. Again, that's beyond dispute, and Nancy Pelosi and Liz Cheney know that. If you really wanted to figure out what happened on January 6th, Peter Navarro would be the last person you would talk to. Instead, you'd be talking to Ray Epps and various FBI informants. But finding out what happened on January 6th and why is not the point of the exercise. The point of the exercise is preventing Donald Trump from running for president again. So in the service of that goal, Pelosi and Liz Cheney demanded that Peter Navarro surrender records of his private conversations with his former boss, President Donald Trump. And when he refused to do that, Congress voted to hold him in contempt in a partisan vote, and then Merrick Garland's Justice Department filed criminal charges against Peter Navarro. This is not the way civilized countries operate. Just because you control the White House and both houses of Congress does not mean you get to throw your political opponents behind bars. That's not what we do in America. That's what they do in Haiti. But that's what we're doing now. And Peter Navarro is not the first. Biden's Justice Department also arrested former Trump advisor Steve Bannon for a similar fake crime. Steve Bannon is awaiting trial this summer. So this is not something we've seen before. It's a huge step toward the politics of the third world. But the media, whose job you thought it was to push back against power, are not. They're in fact applauding because it turns out no punishment is too severe for those who disagree with the national news media. Watch them gloat.
What happened to Peter Navarro is what should have happened to Peter Navarro. He was indicted. And when you're indicted, you're arrested.
What Peter Navarro did, it was so far out of bounds, it's so indefensible.
This prosecution is really about punishing Navarro based on his blatant disrespect for the congressional subpoena.
So they really are your enemies. They're not covering the news. They're plotting ways to hurt you. That's true. Congressional subpoenas are not optional, they lecture you. Comply with them or go to jail. That's the message the lawyers on television are sending. So let's pretend for a moment that that was true, though it's in fact not true. If there was in fact a law like that, for that law to be legitimate, it would have to be, like all laws, applied equally across the board. And no less than the Attorney General himself has said that again and again and again. I came to work here, he said, because we're committed to the rule of law and to seeking equal justice under the law. That was Merrick Garland in January. Quote, we conduct every investigation guided by the same norms. Now, those are the norms under which this country has lived for 250 years. It's not justice unless it's applied equally to all adult American citizens, period. Anything less than that is by definition not justice. But we're getting much less than that, and it's very obvious. Here's just one example. 10 years ago this month, Congress voted overwhelmingly on a bipartisan vote, by the way, 17 Democrats, to hold Eric Holder, then the Attorney General, in criminal contempt of Congress. Holder had refused to turn over documents showing how the Obama administration had armed the Mexican drug cartels. Do you remember that? One of the firearms they sent to Mexico under the so-called Fast and Furious program was then used to murder a U.S. Border Patrol officer. It was a scandal at the time, in case you don't recall. Watch.
Border Patrol agent Brian Terry died in December 2010, killed by guns tied to an Obama administration plan that armed Mexicans. A scandal officials tried to hide by wrongly claiming executive privilege. Emails contained in the House Oversight Committee's report show top officials knew the ATF sent guns to Mexico even before Terry's death. Even the Border Patrol, which sent Terry's team into the desert, didn't know about the operation.
So that was a legitimate scandal that implicated the entire U.S. government, people who actually have power, not the retirees sitting in jail because of what they did on January 6th, but people with actual power. And Eric Holder was at the very center of it. But Holder refused to comply with a subpoena from the Congress. Did the FBI arrest Eric Holder for that? Please. It was never even seriously considered. Holder asserted executive privilege, the right to have conversations with the executive, the president, that are private. He cited the long-standing policy of respecting executive privilege. And he got away with it. So a week ago, Peter Navarro made this exact point. He sued the Justice Department, pushing back against this subpoena 4 days before he was arrested. And in that suit, Navarro cited policy written by the DOJ's Office of Legal Counsel. That policy reads this way, quote, "Since the 1970s, this office has consistently advised that the president and his immediate advisors are absolutely immune from testimonial compulsion by a congressional committee on matters related to their official duties," end quote. In other words, if somebody asserts executive privilege, at the very least, Congress doesn't get to arrest them. Before anyone is arrested, they have to go to a judge to rule on whether or not executive privilege is valid in this case. And that's exactly what happened in Eric Holder's case. And by the way, the federal judge rejected Eric Holder's executive privilege claim, and still, he was not arrested. Why? You know why. Because he's a leading Democrat. But in Peter Navarro's case, Merrick Garland's DOJ did not even bother to ask a judge. They just arrested Peter Navarro at National Airport. So what we're seeing here isn't really about Peter Navarro or Steve Bannon. What we're seeing is a massive escalation in the use by the Democratic Party of our justice system for partisan revenge. That's exactly what that was. Peter Navarro wouldn't shut up, so they threw him in handcuffs. And in fact, at the same moment Peter Navarro was thrown in jail for asserting executive privilege, a Clinton lawyer called Michael Sussman was acquitted by a jury seated by an Obama-appointed judge. Three of the jurors in that case gave money to Hillary Clinton's campaign, and not surprisingly, those same jurors declined to punish Michael Sussman for lying to the FBI to advance the Russia collusion myth that helped Hillary Clinton's campaign. Following all this, how'd those jurors get on the jury? How'd they stay there? Now, the FBI pretended to be outraged by the fact that Michael Sussman had lied to them, but then we learned, actually, the FBI was working with Michael Sussman and his law firm, Perkins Coie. Perkins Coie had an FBI workspace in its offices in Washington for a decade. And Michael Sussman was so close to the FBI, he had a key card to FBI headquarters. We know this from a recently released text exchange. We're quoting, "Do you have a badge or do you need help getting into the building?" The FBI's general counsel, James Baker, asked Sussman. And we're quoting now, "I have a badge," Sussman replied. Sussman had a badge to the FBI building? How do we get one of those? Oh, we're not leading Democratic lawyers, so we can't have them. So Michael Sussman knew he'd never be punished. Take three steps back. What's going on here? In a fantastic piece today at The Federalist, Ben Weingarten explained how we should understand these two prosecutions. Quote, "They send an unmistakable message. We can get you anytime, anywhere, on any grounds we choose. You can't touch even a single one of ours." That's it, right there. This is a partisan play by a political party that has somehow completely taken over our largest law enforcement agency. And Andrew Sussman is not, Michael Sussman is not even the biggest example of this. Andrew McCabe, Lisa Page, Peter Strzok, all of them lied to the feds as well. That's a crime. None of them were ever hauled off in leg irons. In fact, they're now at CNN, MSNBC, and Georgetown, respectively. They were rewarded with better jobs for what they did. They always are. Jim Clapper and John Brennan committed perjury on television before Congress. There's no dispute about that. What do they do? Oh, they're on TV now, too. Hunter Biden lied on a federal gun form. That's a felony. How was he punished? Oh, a mild probing on CBS that he just shrugged off as if it were nothing. Watch.
Why did you have a gun?
Well, I did, again, you know, the period of my life that was difficult. It was, but, you know, I don't know.
According to the reporting, at one point the Secret Service went looking for the record of sale. Do you know anything about that?
Nothing, no.
But you know about the Secret Service being involved?
No, I had no idea. I don't know whether the Secret Service were or why they would be, or I don't think that that's true.
I don't know why the Secret Service were involved. Really? You had no idea? Because they were with you. They helped you. You committed a gun felony. It's all out there. But Hunter Biden is the president's son. And more importantly, he's a faithful party loyalist. So you know, as well as he doesn't have a thing to worry about. In fact, he can flaunt his crimes. RadarOnline.com just got pictures of Hunter Biden casually waving his illegal firearm around as he cavorted with a prostitute several years ago. The pictures show Hunter Biden's finger on the trigger of the gun, as well as crack cocaine and drug paraphernalia. A weapon of war in the hands of a drug addict. Is the Justice Department bothered by this? No, of course not. You know what bothers the Justice Department quite a bit? Defying the Democratic Party. Do that, and your house gets raided by a SWAT team that tips off CNN before it happens. Roger Stone discovered that the hard way.
Exclusive footage you're looking at right now from CNN as the FBI arrives at Roger Stone's residence in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, taking him into custody. They arrived before dawn there, before 6 a.m., or just after 6 a.m. A dozen officers were told.
FBI, open the door.
So that's the actual norm. If you were Tony Podesta and you work for the Democratic Party, you're totally fine. Nothing you do is going to get you in trouble, and you know it. If you're Roger Stone, you've done nothing wrong at all, but you've given the finger to the Democratic Party, they show up at your house with guns. That's the norm the Attorney General is upholding. Serve the Democratic Party, and you will be rewarded, even if you're a felon. At almost exactly the moment the DOJ was putting Peter Navarro in shackles, the DOJ was also dropping the most serious charges against the two left-wing lawyers who tried to incinerate cops, burn them to death in their patrol cars during the BLM riots. Now, this pair had faced 30 years in jail on terrorism charges, but that was too tough for the Biden DOJ. Now, they'll be out in a couple, max. Why? Because they've got the right politics. And Liz Cheney's not giving you a lecture about people who try to burn police officers to death are a threat to our democracy. No, they're fine. We're just going to ignore them. It never happened. This happens all the time. In California, at the height of the BLM riots, a career felon called Tony Walker executed a 19-year-old Berkeley student called Seth Smith. Walked up for no reason, never seen him before in his life, and executed him, fired a gun into the back of his head. Why did he do this? Because of his skin color. It was a racially motivated attack. F that white MF-er, Walker said. No one denies that. He said that. But here's the interesting thing. A guy's just executed on the street because he's got the wrong skin color? Sounds like a hate crime, right? No. Merrick Garland's DOJ did not pursue hate crime charges. In fact, a month ago, prosecutors caught an unbelievable deal with Walker. They sentenced him on a single charge of, brace yourself, voluntary manslaughter. F that white MF-er, he said, as he executed a college student. That sounds like voluntary manslaughter. This is a dangerous trend, and not just because people are dying. Nothing destroys the legitimacy of our institutions more than politicized law enforcement. You can't have that. Justice must be blind. If there is a single institution we have to preserve for the sake of our children and grandchildren, it's our justice system and the law enforcement agencies that serve it. They can't be corrupt. If they're corrupt, it's going to be pretty hard to live here. Liz Cheney and Nancy Pelosi and the rest of the lunatics on the January 6th committee have done far more damage to this democracy than the rioters ever did. Far more. And now they're trying to make it worse. Axios is reporting that some members of the committee, quote, want big changes on voting rights and even to abolish the Electoral College. Abolishing the Electoral College. And if you're against that, of course, you're undermining democracy.
Was it a conspiracy?
I think certainly. I mean, look, if you look at the court filings,
it was a conspiracy?
I do. It is extremely broad. It's extremely well organized. It's really chilling.
Oh, it's really chilling. What's really chilling is when the committee gets to arrest people, not because they violated meaningful laws or pose a threat to the United States, but because their politics are unacceptable, because they have given the finger to people like Liz Cheney. Is Liz Cheney okay with that? The upholder of democracy? We texted Liz Cheney on Friday and said, are you okay with this? They just arrested a 72-year-old man who did nothing wrong. Doesn't that cross some kind of line? Are you going to stand up and say something about it? She didn't respond. The January 6th committee has just hired a former producer of Good Morning America called James Goldston. He'll be overseeing the committee's primetime hearings on Thursday night. So the show trial now has a production crew. And, of course, we'll be covering that in great detail on Thursday. By arresting Peter Navarro, they're hoping to shut up one of the most vocal critics before it begins.
We have Liz Cheney again being interviewed, and she calls a cult of personality, or the people that are followers and supporters of Trump or part of a cult or something. It goes on and on with all this information. But I want everybody to come in to my site, thesecrettruth.com. But I had some photographs up there that I first found on Serendipity way back in 2001. And I'm going to have some other clips, too, about what people, comments they made right there during the event of 9/11, what they had to say about incoming planes on the radar and things like this. So come in there and see that on thesecrettruth.com, some of the photographs. Coming up next is a interview that Sandra Smith had of Fox with Mo Brooks, and it got a little heated. They just make these absolute statements, just like Liz Cheney did, that there was no fraud whatsoever of the 2020 election. They just say that like everybody's gonna believe it, you know what I mean? But nobody believes all of that sometimes. So here we go with this interview. Mo Brooks running for his U.S. district race in Alabama. He's a good guy.
He's now Republican Congressman and Alabama Senate candidate Mo Brooks. Congressman, welcome and thank you for joining us here on Fox News Sunday.
Thank you, Sandra.
So you heard just a moment ago there, Republican Senator John Cornyn of Texas and some other Republican members of Congress have spoken out as well. They're suggesting that perhaps there could be some common ground found here on gun legislation in the wake of this most recent shooting. Would you support any changes, sir, to the current gun laws on the books?
Well, let's, for emphasis, understand what the Second Amendment is about. The Second Amendment is designed to help ensure that we, the citizenry, always have the right to take back our government should it become dictatorial. That was a great fear of the Founding Fathers, and quite frankly, it's a fear today. And as long as we enjoy uninfringed Second Amendment rights, then we don't really have to worry that much about the government ever becoming dictatorial. But the moment that we take from our citizenry our ability to take our government back is the moment that the ability of dictatorial forces increases to the point where perhaps they will try to implement a dictatorial government at the federal level. So I want to protect the Second Amendment right to bear arms. The amendment is very clear. It says the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. If there are proposals out there that guarantee the rights of the American people to freely exercise their Second Amendment right to bear and keep arms, then I'll consider them. But if you're talking about depriving people of their Second Amendment right to bear arms, well, first, it's unconstitutional. So you're going to have to address that with a constitutional amendment, and we'll see how Congress and the states react to that kind of measure. But second, it's not the proper way to go if you want to preserve our freedoms. And I say that having been the target of an assassination attempt on a baseball field in Virginia where 170 some odd bullets were fired over about a 7-minute period of time. So I've been in the middle of one of these things, and I was a primary target of the assassin where he had my name, my physical description in his pocket at the time he launched this attack. What we have to do is stop the motivation that causes these criminals, these horrific individuals, to do what they do.
I want to dig into that in just a moment, because you did say some things on that this week. But first, to the specific gun laws in your state, sir. The minimum age in your state to buy an AR-15, like the one the school shooter used in Uvalde, is 18 years old. There's no waiting period between the time that a firearm is purchased and when it's actually turned over to the buyer. There's no license for the sale of ammunition. Gallup research does find that a majority of Americans, 52% of them, are in favor of stricter gun laws when it comes to the sale of firearms. So to the majority of Americans who feel that way, you say what?
Well, I suggest that the polling data that you have does not really reflect the opinions of the American people. I suspect that the people who were polled, by way of example, were not properly explained what the purpose of the Second Amendment right to bear arms is. And I'll use my own history as an example. There were many times when I went to school with a shotgun in my car. Why? Because I just got through duck hunting. There are other teenagers my age at that point in time that also brought their weapons to school, and they had been hunters too, for whatever it is the hunting season was about. Now, back when I was growing up, we didn't have these mass killings, okay? They weren't there. They didn't occur. Or if they did, I certainly was not cognizant of them, and they were very, very, very rare, so rare that I cannot recall a single instance in which one of those things occurred during my youth. Today, they're much more common. What's the big difference between when I was growing up and today? The big difference is a decline in the moral values, a decline in the respect for human life. If we teach proper moral values, if we teach respect for human life, if we properly address mental health issues that may somehow or another be associated with all these things, then that is the way to fix the problem.
Okay. So to that point, this week you suggested just that, what you believe is behind the rising number of mass shootings in America. You said this: it reflects poorly on liberal policies that encourage out-of-wedlock childbirth, divorce, single-parent households, and amoral values that undermine respect for life. Mass killings that are common in America today were, as you just stated, when I grew up, a very rare thing. The way to prevent mass killings, you say, is to restore moral values. I'll dig into that more in just a second. But does that statement, sir, unfairly blame single-parent households in this country for the rise of mass shootings?
Absolutely not. It blames moral values decline in the United States of America, and there are a lot of factors that have contributed to our moral decline. By way of example, all the studies I've ever seen suggest that children who are raised with just one parent around, they don't do as well by the time they become adults. Why? Because it's almost impossible for a single parent to do the kind of job that two parents collectively can do. It's just a numbers game. And there are a lot of single parents that do an excellent job raising their kids, but they are super parents. And I thank them for the effort that they've put forth in producing children who later become responsible adults. But unfortunately, the data is very clear. Those single-parent households, for whatever reason, end up resulting in children who are more likely to be on welfare, who are less likely to get the kind of grades you expect to get in school, who are more likely to be involved in drugs, and who, unfortunately, are more likely to be involved in criminal conduct. That's just the data.
So,
and that's not to say that all single parents do that, okay? That is not the data. We're talking about probabilities and tendencies, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5% greater probability, that has an effect on society.
So restoring moral values, that's, you're calling for glacial change there. People want to know what can be done today. Aren't you then making the case for red flag laws that could help these communities identify someone who owns a firearm, who doesn't have respect for human life? They have been adopted in 19 states, but not Alabama. Would you support that?
Under the United States Constitution, before you can do something to this kind of individual, you have to show, one, that their mind's off a little bit, and two, that they have engaged in some kind of conduct that would warrant you taking the appropriate kind of action against them, by way of example, to house them for their own protection or protection of others. It might be a non-compos mentis, a mental capacity type of hearing. There are laws already on the books to take care of those types of issues. issues. The problem is identifying them and identifying them as opposed to the problem associated with misidentifying others. And there has to be a balance. And that's a real challenge for our probate courts around the country and every other governmental body or person who is responsible for determining when someone becomes a risk to themselves and to others. That's a very difficult thing to mind read.
So is it fair to say you could be, if it was written correctly, open to some sort of red flag law in your state?
I'm not talking about red flag laws. I'm talking about a person who is a danger to others that we already have laws for that are already on the books, okay? Mm-hmm. If you've got some kind of mental issue and you are a danger to yourself or a danger to others, then you already can be subject to court jurisdiction and the appropriate court remedies to ensure that you're no longer a danger to yourself and to others. That is this now. That's been on the books in Alabama for decades, and I believe it's been on the books throughout the country for decades.
Several speakers, meanwhile, sir, chose not to attend this week's NRA event in Texas, including Governor Greg Abbott and Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick. The NRA endorsed you recently. Do you believe it was appropriate to hold that meeting in Texas?
I'm not going to comment on the meeting in Texas because I'm not a part of it, but I very much appreciate that the National Rifle Association, Gun Owners of America, and the National Association of Gun Rights have endorsed me in this United States Senate race in Alabama over all other comers. That says a lot about who's going to actually fight to defend the Second Amendment right to bear arms, and in Alabama, that's a big deal.
All right. On to the Senate primary runoff and the former President Donald Trump. You're now in a runoff in the Alabama Senate primary against Katie Britt, who I should note we did invite to join us here today, but she was unavailable. All of this is happening after former President Trump decided to unendorse you, sir, saying you had blown it by going, quote, woke, for not talking about what he says was 2020 election fraud. What exactly did the president ask you to do after the 2020 election?
The president and I had many conversations between September 1st and his decision to unendorse me that revolved around his being reinstated, revolved around his wanting to rescind the election. And I can understand him wanting to do that, okay? He was robbed in my judgment in 2020. In his judgment, he was robbed. And so I can understand that desire. The conflict was when I would explain the law does not permit us to do that. Our one shot at reversing the election, our one shot in an election contest under the United States Constitution and federal law is on January 6th. That's it. That's the final appeal date. So anything we do after that has to focus on winning the 2022 and 2024 elections. We can use what happened in 2020 as a motivation to try to get better election laws, to use as a motivation to win in 2022 and 2024 to save our country. But what is now done in 2020 is irreversible under the United States Constitution and the United States Code. And I'm one of those who believes in law and order. I might not like it that that's the end game, but that is the end game.
And just to go on the record, there has been still no evidence or proof provided that there was any sort of fraud in that.
Well, no, that's wrong. I don't know why you people in the media keep saying that, but that is absolutely false. That is absolutely false. You keep saying it every time, but that's absolutely
false.
You had 150 congressmen and senators who absolutely disagreed with you on what you just said. So what are you calling them? What are you calling them when you say 150 Republican senators and congressmen looked at the voter fraud issue and said there was a major problem? What are you calling the Commission on Federal Election Reform, a bipartisan committee with Jimmy Carter on the one hand and James Baker, Ronald Reagan, White House Chief of Staff on the other, back in 2005, who analyzed the systemic weaknesses, the systemic flaws in our election system and warned us that elections are going to be stolen if we don't fix these problems, and those problems were not fixed.
Okay.
So I don't know who's telling you there's no evidence, but that tells me you haven't done your homework. I'm sorry, but
judges,
that's the way it is.
The courts and the judges that have...
No, the courts...
On the
wait, time out. Don't go into that. Don't go into that.
All right.
Don't go into that.
Though,
the courts do not have the... Wait a minute. No. I'm getting in the last word on this one because you just made a false statement, okay? The courts are not the final arbiter of who wins federal election contests. Congress is. That is required by the United States Constitution. That is required by the United States Code for congressmen and senators and the president. So don't be surprised that courts authorized the United States Congress.
Let me just quote the GOP commissioner in Wisconsin in the Wall Street Journal today. Printed and I will read it verbatim. He said, there is no evidence that election fraud is the reason Trump lost in Wisconsin, and that is not for lack of looking. His advice to your party is to pivot away from these conspiracy theories, focus on the issue that affects Wisconsin families and their pocketbooks. Sir, I want to move on to January 6th.
Okay, then look at the judge's opinion. Look at the judge's opinion in Pennsylvania that talked about over 2 million illegal ballots cast. That was their court order. Look
sir,
at the special investigation
the
of a former Wisconsin Supreme Court justice who found significant voter fraud at nursing homes in the state of Wisconsin. Okay. Look at the 2,000 Mules documentary that has come out. Look at how many mass mail-out of ballots there were across the United States for which we have no security.
Okay, and that has been looked at and fact-checked by multiple outlets, including Reuters, who have debunked that as any sort of proof that there was widespread voter fraud.
I'm sorry, but other people have fact-checked it and find you absolutely wrong, Senator, but keep going with that story if you wish.
Okay, thank you, sir. Respectfully, I want to move on to January 6th and the committee. Have you been subpoenaed? Have you been served a subpoena, as it has been confirmed four other Republican congressmen have?
I don't know if the committee has issued a subpoena or not, okay, because I haven't been privy to any conversations with them. All I hear are media reports, but I can say for a fact that I have not been served with any kind of documentation, and there is no subpoena until it's been served on the person to whom it is directed.
Okay, and you have signaled this week that you're not going to comply unless certain conditions are met, including testifying in public. Should we expect to, if you are indeed served or have been served, to see you testifying in public before this committee?
Well, I have to get with my colleagues who have been purportedly subpoenaed. At least they say they have been served. I don't know why I haven't, and some of them have. I guess with Kevin McCarthy, he went out of his way to accept service. But I've looked at some of their communications to the Witch Hunt Committee, and I believe that some of their communications have merit. But the things with me that I require is, first, it's got to be public. It's got to be something that you at Fox News can have a camera on so that the American people can see it. No more of this clandestine meeting stuff, secret meeting stuff involving the public's business. No more of these little leakages, okay? It's got to be in public. It's got to be congressman to congressman. It's got to be limited to issues associated with January the 6th. And it has to be after this Senate primary is over with. I don't want this witch hunt committee, Nancy Pelosi, trying to interfere with a Republican primary election for the United States Senate in Alabama.
Congressman, lastly, looking ahead, if you win this runoff, what is the plan to win in November?
Well, I'm going to beat the Democrats. I have a history of beating Democrats like a drum, and I see no reason why this general election in November would be any different. They are socialists. They are dictatorial. They are amoral. They are absolutely the opposite of what we believe in the state of Alabama. My record against Democrats is 14 wins, zero losses. That's a pretty good record, and I'll defend that against any other comer in this Republican primary. Best I understand, none of the other Republicans running in this race had won even a single election. None of them have ever held public office before. I'm the only one that's ever held public office. I'm the only one who's ever beat the Democrats. And unlike in 2017 when we elected a Democrat to the United States Senate from Ruby Red, Alabama, if Mo Brooks is the nominee, it ain't happening. And if you want to help, please go to MoBrooks.com.
Congressman, thank you very much for joining us today here on Fox News Sunday. It's always good to speak with you. Thank you, sir.
My pleasure. Very lively.
Okay. Up next, we will bring our...
Going with a little bit of lighter here, next is an interview that Alex Jones had with Mike Tyson. And they jostle around and have a good time. We're sort of lightening up a little bit. Then we're going to finish with Jay Dyer. He got some very, very insightful things to say about some of these television serials coming up. So here we go with Mike Tyson and Alex Jones joshing around. You know how two men get together, they're going to jostle each other. So here we go next.
Everybody knows that I am the biggest fan of hot boxing.
Thank you. Thank you.
With who knows this guy, this legend right here. And we have the new Mike Bites that I got to say are amazing. Very nutritious, and I really enjoyed taking one.
And I enjoy spending time with you. I thought I was coming to meet the head of the KKK at first. They were talking about this guy's beautiful brother, man.
Well, what made you go ahead and do it? They said, don't talk to me.
Well, because they see that about me, so I understand how that is.
And it's all good now.
I know you're a human being. I know you love people. I know people love you, so you can't be bad.
Yes, sir.
If someone loves you, you can't be bad.
Absolutely. If somebody loves you, you can't be bad. That's right. Thank you, sir.
My brother.
InfoWars, the most banned network in the world.
Wow, here we are. Ladies and gentlemen, Mike Tyson, the Maverick, legend, the American success story. Thank you very much, sir.
It's my pleasure.
It was great just being on your show.
I don't know. Maybe are you hiding something? Because somebody told me you were a bad dude, man. I can't find it. I'm a good judge of character. I don't see it.
No, it's been
you got your opinions like I have mine, but I don't see it.
It's been a misrepresentation, just like they've done to you. I mean, none of us are perfect, but they take the bad moments and they blow them up, and then that's what they make the thing.
I thought I was coming to talk to a Tiff down from the KKK.
Ah, yeah.
By the way, I told them that I had some of my bad hands. Joke, what? There was no love in the house.
Yeah, I'm the opposite of KKK. Well, I appreciate your time. Let's talk about one of our mutual friends, Joe Rogan.
Yes.
What do you make of all the attempts to cancel him? And I think it's only made him bigger. What do you think about that?
I just think some people are so, I'm not going to say blasphemous, but you're so undignified. They feel as if, I don't want to hear that. How dare him say that when it's not even directed towards you? People want to fight other battles that don't even concern them. You know, I don't know if that's the root of the world, but everybody wants to fight. That's what this country is all about. We have to fight something. If we can't fight something, we fight ourselves. We kill ourselves with drugs. And that's just the state of our country. It's been born on that physical altercation.
Yeah, and so they see Joe getting big, so they decide to make him a villain.
Yeah, listen, this country must have invented jealousy.
Yeah.
This country, yeah.
Why is America the most successful, but also the best, but also the most evil? It seems like a paradox, like it's all going on.
Because the reason why America's so successful was because of the yin and yang, the balance. If this was a perfect world, if we lived in a perfect world with all the food and all the money that we could even handle, we would peel off in groups, we'd kill each other, rape each other, and then we'd stop mating, and then we'd all die out. That's what a perfect world would do. I mean, I just have fun doing it. Like, this is the highlight, too.
Are you glad you did the interview?
Oh, man.
Because they told you not to do it. In closing, what do you make of cancel culture and attempts for people to not have you interview me?
I just think, what kind of culture is that?
Cancel culture.
Cancel culture. That's not nothing but communist, man. If he's bad, we all don't like him. And if you like him, you're bad, too. That's communism.
Awesome. Mike Tyson, thank you. Boom.
We're going to finish with Jay Dyer, but thank you for listening. And then after that, you'll hear the exit music. So here we go with Jay Dyer.
The Austin Jones Show. I'm your guest host, Jay Dyer, of Jay's Analysis. You know, it's been about probably 6 or 7 months since on the fourth hour we covered anything related to Hollywood and the industry and the arts and all of that. We've focused so heavily on geopolitical texts, the writings of the elite. If you go back into the band.video archives in the last 2 years, you'll find many, many, many lectures from those writings that we've done. Today I want to return to something that I wrote my two books on, which is the influence of propaganda in film and literature. And what recently occurred was, as I'm sure many of you know, the fourth season of Stranger Things. Stranger Things is the wildly popular Netflix series, which took off 4 or 5 years ago, maybe 6 years ago, as a nostalgia piece hearkening back to the 1980s. And what's interesting about the show isn't playing on nostalgia and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I think we're kind of getting bored with that. I mean, basically all movies, I mean, Jurassic Park just came out. And once again, we have, basically just regurgitating the same plots, the same narrative, the same oddities. Once again, we have Jeff Goldblum. He's there doing the chaos mathematician shtick over and over and over. I mean, how many times do we have to see the same things
in these big series. Well, what was interesting about Stranger Things wasn't so much all of the archetypal, repetitive 80s arcana, but the propaganda that they interjected into not just the whole series, but particularly seasons 3 and 4. So if you don't recall, just to kind of recap, the series takes place in a small Indiana town in the early 80s. In the midst of the Cold War, we have explicit references to the nuclear threat of the Cold War. And the plot centers around a secret program at a Department of Energy facility in this small town. What we find out is that the Department of Energy cover there is really a mind control tapping into the next dimension CERN type of thing. So it gets weirder and weirder as the series progresses. But initially, we have season one focusing explicitly on the MKUltra programs. It even comes up in the series. It's explicitly mentioned when some of the characters start doing research into why these bizarre events are occurring in this town. We have missing children taking place in the 80s. And in season one, just to summarize, I assume most people have seen it. I'm not going to go into too many details about the plot, but you have this figure who's sort of the handler to the children that he's experimenting on, and he's kind of a composite of maybe Timothy Leary or Dr. John C. Lilly or a Jose Delgado. And for those that don't recall, those are prominent MKUltra figures, doctors who were really involved in the program, perhaps even Dr. Ewan Cameron, who were directly involved in testing, experimenting on children, especially in the case of Dr. John C. Lilly. He mentions this in his book, Programming and Metaprogramming in the Human Biocomputer. And the idea was that if we could maybe kickstart evolution, if we could, even at the expense of abusing the youth, abusing children, or even giving them LSD in many cases, sort of spur on the next stage of human evolution. And I don't know for sure, but I speculate that this had to do with picking out, profiling high IQ children, particularly gifted children, and seeing if they were able to, kickstart or tap into the creative process of high IQ children or creatively gifted children, and then try to weaponize that. And quite a few TV shows have capitalized on this. And if you follow my work, you know that I've delved into the research of people like Dave McGowan, people like Douglas Valentine and his book, The Phoenix Program, where we covered the programs that the CIA had cooked up particularly during Vietnam, to create cannibal serial killers. This is a real thing. It's detailed in the Phoenix Program book. It was a real program. How extensive it was, we don't know. Likewise, other programs such as Dr. Thomas Nerritt of the Navy had discussed in public interviews that the Navy had their own separate program where they sort of experimented with psychotics, perverts, psychos to sort of train them to become assassins and killers. Tom O'Neill has a recent book out that kind of hints at some of this, where he details the, it's called Chaos, where he connects Manson to various, perhaps mind control type of programs. So we know a lot of this is going on. There are quite a few hard details that we can pin down in these programs, but as to who was in these programs, of course, that's up for debate. We don't know for sure. Some of the serial killers, for example, did have a role to play in certain mind control programs. Some of them were explicitly involved in MKUltra, like the Unabomber. We know that David Berkowitz in his military time, that he did experiment with LSD and that it did, quote, change his personality. But as to whether they were specifically part of mind control programs, the serial killers, that is, that's up for some speculation. But there are some details that suggest that, especially the timing of a lot of the serial killers being stationed in Vietnam and being given assassin-type training. Now, back to Stranger Things, the reason this is relevant is because the show is explicitly playing upon the Stanford research projects, which dealt with tapping into and trying to weaponize occult practices.